Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Alina is, well, she's always bouncing off the walls, let's be honest, but she's especially excited today. Why are you especially excited, Alina?
Because today is World War II Day. I'm always excited on a World War II Day. But we've got with us today Chris Millington, who's a lecturer in modern European history at Manchester Metropolitan University. He specialises in the history of modern France and violence, and he's published books like From Victory to Vichy: Veterans in Interwar France, and his most recent book, France in the Second World War: Collaboration, Resistance, Holocaust, Empire. But today we're going to concentrate on one very small aspect during the Second World War, and that is Vichy France. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, Alina's in love with you already. This is a jolly subject. She loves
I
subjects.
got the book, and I got it from you actually, funnily enough, when you sent me that batch of books. And it's I was literally telling Chris before we started recording, it's on my Polish World War II shelf, and it's the only French book. It has the prime spot.
What an honor.
You just said you basically lockdown means nothing to you because you have two children, so you've been in lockdown for 4 years anyway.
Yeah, no, I couldn't go out anyway, so nothing's changed.
Brilliant. What's the one thing you are going to do when everything reopens, though?
Go to soft play,
Okay.
which I do enjoy.
Yeah. Oh, that's all right then. Just don't enjoy it too much, otherwise
No.
you're a weirdo,
I
right?
will. I will be going with my children.
Yeah. Oh, I got my cup final ticket yesterday. I'm going out into the world. I'm going to be sitting in a three quarters empty Wembley Stadium next weekend, which I'm sure
All
will
by
be.
yourself.
I know. I'm wondering if I can even. Are we even allowed to sit near each other within that? I have friends that are going, but are we going to like have to sit apart? I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about France. I tell you what, because let's just take it for granted that some people are like me and that they're not particularly experts in this. I know that France got invaded. What is the situation in France towards the end of June 1940? So that's after Dunkirk, isn't it? So that's like there's no liberation coming. So what happens after that fails?
Well, I think it's difficult to underestimate the catastrophe that has happened in France in June 1940. Probably, I know I'm French historian saying this, one of the biggest catastrophes of the 20th century. So France is invaded, as you say, by Germany in May, on the 10th of May 1940. And 5 days later, the French Prime Minister says to Winston Churchill, we've lost the battle after 5 days. And the disaster kind of unfolds over the next month as the Allies desperately try to fight back. But by the middle of June, the French recognize that it's over, and there is only one thing left to do, and that's to ask for an armistice with the Nazis. And this is Marshal Philippe Pétain, who was the Prime Minister of France at the time. He announces on the 17th of June that there's going to be an end to the fighting.
Oh, he's
And
going to come up a lot, isn't he?
yes, he's kind of like the one figure of continuity throughout this whole period of
As a
occupation.
World War One historian, in my world, he's like the hero of France, but he definitely that doesn't end that way, does it?
No, not at all. He kind of blots his copybook a little bit
A little bit.
after 1918. So he is the head of state, the head of this Vichy state between 1940 and 1944, in France. Technically dictator, although he's not as all powerful as we might think a dictator would be.
You know, the one thing I will always remember is the date that Paris fell. Okay, yeah, I am going to bring in some concentration camp stuff because I have to. But it's the one day I remember because it is the day the first transport arrives to Auschwitz, which is the 14th of June 1940. It's really interesting if you watch what happens in places like Poland when that does happen and Paris falls. So, for example, in Kraków, the whole place is just like festooned with like swastikas and they're singing and they're firing their guns in the air and they're drinking. And it's this massive celebratory moment. And then you just watch the Poles just go, shit.
Yes, yeah. Well, I was read somewhere that Hitler had ordered the bells in Germany to ring for a week. I don't know if they rang continuously for a week, but there's huge celebrations in Germany, and of course there's a victory parade in Paris, which the French have to endure pretty much on a weekly basis throughout the whole occupation, because so the Germans like to rub the French noses in it.
Right, so we're actually here to talk about Vichy France. We've got the scene set. We know what's happening in France. So can you expect, I mean, I know what Vichy France is. I'm assuming Alex knows what Vichy France is, but some, like she said, some of our listeners might not know. So can you explain to our listeners what actually is the Vichy regime? Where is it?
Good. That's a good question. So the Vichy regime is essentially the government that runs France between July 1940 and the liberation in August 1944. It takes over from what was called the Third Republic, which was this democratic parliamentary regime. So there is regime change in France after the defeat to Nazi Germany. And it's regime change that's affected by the parliamentarians of the Republic. So they actually all get together at Vichy and under the authority of the Prime Minister, Marshal Pétain, and they vote the Third Republic out of existence because they see that this is such a catastrophe for France that something new needs to happen. They blame the Republic for the defeat. They see this disaster as evidence that there was something inherently wrong with the Republic of the interwar years, or actually it goes back to 1870, the Third Republic. So it's not a Nazi requirement. And in fact, if you look at a country like Denmark, they did have some semblance of parliamentary democracy under the occupation, under Nazi occupation. So the French did have an option to continue with the Republic, but they decide to found this authoritarian Vichy regime under Pétain. And this is, it's kind of broadly welcomed by the French public because of, as we've just mentioned, who Pétain is from the First World War, this war hero. He's a very grandfatherly figure. He's in his mid-80s in 1940, and he portrays himself as this saviour of the nation. And if we think about the French are stunned and humiliated and distraught in 1940, who better to kind of steady the ship and take things in a new direction than this man who's seen as the embodiment of France itself?
Oh boy, did they get that wrong though, didn't they? Vichy France, how is it divided and what is the Forbidden Zone?
Okay, yes, whenever I read about the Forbidden Zone, I think of the Planet of the Apes.
I know, yeah. That's the only reason I asked, because it was so exciting.
Yeah, there is no Statue of Liberty in the French Forbidden Zone. Oh, I've ruined the ending there of Planet of the Apes, haven't I?
That's right. They've had like 60 years to watch it now.
Well, so France is carved up by the Germans. So the Germans occupy the northern half of France and the Atlantic coastline. So this is the occupied zone. This is where the German troops are and where German military and security authorities are located. Below this German occupation zone is what's called the Free Zone. So that is technically Vichy. The Vichy zone. And between the north and the south, there is an internal border called the demarcation line, which you need special permission to cross and special documents to get across. And the Germans do shut this border now and again when they're unhappy with the French. So broadly, there's this northern zone and southern zone. Now, confusingly, the French regime in the south, so based at Vichy, does have authority over both zones. The legislation it implements in the south applies to the north as well. It's just that in the north, the Germans can veto decisions and they can impose their own requirements and legislation too. So you've got these broadly two zones in the north and the south, but there are other zones as well. So there is in the north of the country, part of France is put under military control from Belgium. The German military command in Belgium takes two counties of France. And then we have this forbidden zone, which stretches from the Somme in the north to the Jura, which is on the Swiss border. And it comprises six departments, so six counties of France. And it has portions of four other counties in it. Now, the reason this is called the Forbidden Zone is because that people who fled from this region in 1940 are not allowed to return there until 1943. So it's kind of a security zone. And there is also a reserved zone within this area for future German colonization. So that's the Forbidden Zone in the Northeast. And then we have other zones as well. So parts of Alsace are incorporated into the Third Reich and Germanized. And then you have an Italian occupation zone in the southeast of the country. And that's just mainland France. That's just how mainland France is carved up. We've got to remember as well that France is an empire. So you have this imperial zone, I suppose we could call it, which stretches around the world too. So there's the... If you're asking kind of where is Vichy France, it's quite a complex answer.
I mean, I find this so interesting because the Germans do the same in Eastern Europe. So they come into Poland, into Slovakia, and they're carving everything. They have a plan for everything. You know, so this section will be incorporated into the Greater Third Reich. This section here will be for living space. This section here will be for, you know, those dirty Poles or, you know, the Russians or whatever. I did not realise till I picked up your book how extensive it even was in France. I thought it was just happening in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, well, I suppose you are right. However, the plan for France is much different, obviously, than the plan for Poland. So Poland is like wiped off the map, really. But the interesting thing is that at the time, the French, one of the arguments for collaboration or working with the Germans was, well, we don't want to end up like Poland. We don't want Polandization to happen in France. So I think because the Germans don't see France as a land for future settlement, they're not as harsh in France as in Poland, although from my point of view, they're harsh enough.
Clearly, though, I'm sorry, but no offence, Alina. If I was going to future colonise one, I'd take the one with the wine.
Not the vodka.
Oh, you know I'm rubbish on vodka. In terms of practical occupation and how it looked to French people, are there any vast differences between like North and South?
So there are differences in terms of resistance or what's possible in terms of resistance and also collaboration. So if we think about the North, that's where the German soldiers are. So there is a very visible German presence. So just in Paris, there are swastikas everywhere. There is a huge V for victory put on the French Parliament building. And from mid-1941, there's a huge banner on the French Parliament building saying Germany is winning on all fronts, which I suppose in mid-1941 it was. So it's very visible. And so that means that for resistance groups, it's easy for them to say to the French, well, look, here's the enemy. You've got the German military administration. You've got the German security forces under Himmler. The Germans are out in public. So the resistance groups, the early resistance groups, can say, well, what more evidence do you need that we are occupied and that we need to resist? However, that the German presence does mean they're much more fragmented in the North, the resistors, because it's just more difficult to resist because of the German soldiers there. And this German presence has an effect on collaboration as well. So Paris is a hotbed of collaboration during the occupation of France, because all the extremists and these French fascists gravitate towards Paris, because that's where they think that they can most influence Nazi policy on France. So it's quite a bleak situation, I think, in the north of the country. In the south, it's relatively freer, because until the end of 1942, the Germans aren't there. So we might talk about the occupation of France, but it can be quite paradoxical to think that actually there is no occupation in the south for a lot of the war. And that has an interesting effect on the public, because without German soldiers there, it's difficult for early resistors to persuade the public that there is something to resist. So who is the enemy? If you're living in southern France, who is the target? It's not the war hero Marshal Pater, and there aren't any Germans there, so why bother resisting? So there's a lot of public complacency, and even some of the early resistance groups are quite positive about the Vichy regime because of Pater, up until the end of 1941 at the latest. And one of the key things we have to remember about this, these resistors maybe not opposing Pétain as we think they should, is that this means that they are going along with a lot of repressive policies and discriminatory policies as well. So they're in quite an ambiguous position in the South, the early resistance groups.
Can I chuck in? Sorry, Alina, I'm going off on a tangent.
But... Go for it.
What I do. I'm just really interested in the mindset. First of all, in terms of, is there your standard French collaborator, or do they come from across French society? I mean, is there a certain type that is pro-Nazi and excited to see the Nazis come in, or are they not excited? They're just pragmatic.
Yeah, well, the kind of different degrees of collaboration. So at the very extreme end, you have French fascists. It's probably not very well known that France has a very vibrant fascist movement in the interwar years. Now, there's a lot of disagreement amongst historians about what exactly fascism is, but there are several fascist parties in France who can rely on the support of hundreds of thousands of French in the interwar years. These fascist parties are the most extreme collaborators. So some of them argue, well, we want a Nazi France under the occupation. Interestingly, the Nazis aren't very keen on that. The Nazis actually like Vichy because it's not very fascist, because Hitler does not want fascists in the occupied territories causing problems, because remember, fascists are ultra-nationalists as well. So Hitler, I suppose, just wants a quiet life in the occupied territories. So he's happy for Vichy to go along as it is, as a more conservative regime. As for other collaboration or collaborators, it depends on how you define collaboration. So there are people who would define it very broadly. So simply doing anything to allow the occupation to continue, or even doing nothing. So some historians would argue that apathy is collaboration, because you're not actually physically resisting.
This is, I was going to ask you, like, where is the line? I mean, I'm guessing it's still pretty bitter. If you go to someone and start talking in France about their family history, I guess it's quite bitter still, like, where someone becomes defined as a collaborator or someone who just didn't, like, oppose it or just kept their mouth shut to keep their family safe. I'm guessing it's still, the lines are really blurred.
Again, it all depends on your own definition of collaboration and your own definition of what you think people should have done. So this idea that apathy is collaboration, that was put forward by an American historian, Robert Paxton. It's a very harsh assessment of the French. And other historians have preferred terms like accommodation. So you just get on with things and accept things how they are. The thing is, if we adopt this very broad definition of collaboration, you have to ask questions about just ordinary people. So like the postman who delivered letters for the German regime, was he a collaborator because he's delivering the orders of the regime? Or anyone who did not pick up a weapon and shoot a gun at a German soldier, are they collaborators? So
mad, isn't it? It's like, especially in the North, I guess if you're in the South and you haven't done anything, then as far as you're concerned, you're like, well, there was nothing going on, so I'm not a collaborator, I just lived my life. But if you're in the North and there's guys with guns pointed at you and you decide not to oppose it for the sake of not getting shot or not putting your family in danger, then to call you a collaborator is, you're right, it's really harsh, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. We always have to be careful about judging people in the past for the way they behaved, I suppose. But you're right. I'd say that a minority of French are collaborators and a minority are resistors, but the vast majority of people just want to survive. I think maybe coming from the British point of view, or modern British point of view, the fact that we were not invaded or occupied, and also the fact that we might like to kick the French a little bit now and again, might lead us to be a bit harsh on the way the French behaved under the occupation. But they face daily choices about how to behave. As you say, if you just want to protect your family, it's an incredibly difficult time.
It's also that idea of those who just stood by and watched. I mean, that is a massive, massive issue in my field. You know, are you a collaborator because you watched your neighbours being taken away and put into a concentration camp? Because obviously there were a lot of French ended up in Poland, in the concentration camps that were in occupied Poland, because they were, for example, resistant or homosexual or asocial or, you know, a variety of different things. So were you a collaborator because you watched your friend, your aunt, your uncle, whoever be taken away?
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. Unless people, we can only comfortably categorise people if they behaved in a very active way, collaborating or resisting. Another really interesting point about collaboration and resistance is that they generally only apply to the European setting in the French context. If we think about the French Empire, there are certain territories of the French Empire controlled by the Free French, so Charles de Gaulle's forces who resist Vichy. If you are one of the original inhabitants of these territories, one of the indigenous peoples, and you resist Free French colonial government, what does that make you? Does that make you a collaborator with Vichy and the Nazis because you're resisting Charles de Gaulle? Or likewise, if you live in a Vichy-controlled territory of the empire and you oppose their colonial government, does that technically make you a resistor to Nazi Germany? So this is something that historians are looking at more and more. Collaboration and resistance doesn't mean that much for a lot of French subjects.
Right, let's get back on track to some of these questions, because I know Alex likes a little tangent. She started it, I had to finish it. So
they're great questions.
Right, so you have mentioned this very, very briefly a couple of questions beforehand, and that was to do with the Italian zone. Explain this a little bit more, because that does come up in your book.
Yes, so France is at war with Italy in 1940 from the 10th of June. You might recognise that at this point that Italy declares war on France when the battle is already over. Italy invades France on the 20th of June. So this is sort of days before the armistice with Germany, largely because Mussolini thinks this is the right time to do it if I want something from the French. The fascinating thing about the Italian invasion is that the French actually do a good job at repelling it, because the Italians invade through the Alps, and the French fight bravely, and they kind of repulse this Italian invasion. But then what happens is, of course, there is a more general defeat to Germany, and a separate armistice is agreed with Italy on the 24th of June. And as part of this armistice, Hitler agrees to the Italians having this occupation zone in the southeast of France, which has about 20,000 French citizens in it. And it's bordered by a demilitarized area as well, which between France and this Italian zone. And what the Italians try to do in this area, especially in the city of Mantua, is they try to Italianize it. So Mussolini has always said that he wants southeastern regions of France. He thinks that they are I suppose, technically Italian or ethnically Italian. And so he uses the occupation to introduce Italian law into this area of France. He brings in the lira as a legal tender. There are Italian signs put up. Italian is used in schools. And the Italian occupation authorities try to make this area like a shop window for Italian fascism or fascist imperialism. They start to call it Italian Montan, Italian Montan. Now, if you're living in this zone as a French citizen, you have to run all the risks that the French in the northern occupied zone do in terms of surveillance and repression. So you have the OVRA, the Italian secret services there. You have Italian soldiers, the Italian police. This repression, this surveillance expands after November 1942, which is when the Allies invade North Africa, because the Italian occupied zone expands in November 1942. So ultimately Italy gains about 4 million French citizens at the end of 1942. And this is because Germany, something I haven't mentioned, in 42, moves south. So the whole of France is occupied from November 42, because Hitler is worried about an invasion of southern France from North Africa. So this Italian zone is really interesting as kind of a comparison with the German zone. And it's also interesting to look at the way the Vichy government interacts with the Italian government. So Vichy does collaborate with Italy in terms of allowing Italian forces to use French military bases against the British. But it also makes some secret agreements with the Italians about these military resources, because Vichy thinks, well, if we keep something from the Germans and we keep this secret with the Italians, maybe we can drive a wedge between Rome and Berlin, and it will be to our benefit.
Okay, let's have a look at what this whole structure, because it's a bit complicated, this whole structure of the government in Vichy France. And who are these actual people that were in power of Vichy? I mean, did they have influence in Paris, or what were they doing?
Yes, it is a complex regime, and it does change throughout the war years. So when we're thinking about Vichy France, we often have to ask ourselves, well, when, what time period are we talking about? As I mentioned, the one point of continuity is Marshal Pétain. So he's head of the regime throughout the occupation. He's a war hero. He has remained relatively out of politics in the interwar years. He was appointed Minister for War in the 1930s for a brief period, but he never ran for election. He's kind of appointed to this post as an expert, a non-elected expert. And he's very popular in France in the 1930s. In fact, there was this is going to sound a very strange opinion poll conducted in 1935 by a national newspaper asking who would you most like to be French dictator? And Marshal Pétain wins and he wins it by a margin of nearly 200,000 votes. So he's very popular. And this cult of personality continues into the war years. So there is an anthem, Vichy's national anthem, which is called, the translation of the title is, At Your Service, Marshal. School children are encouraged to write to the Marshal. There is a picture of him in all public buildings. In fact, some school children as well, there is evidence that they had pictures of him on the walls of their bedrooms as well. He's so well liked. So he's the one point of continuity. But beneath him, there is a government of ministers that he appoints. And there's probably two men who are most important to know about during the occupation in this government. There is Pierre Laval, who is what's called the deputy prime minister, so essentially the head of the government. And there is Admiral François Darlan. Now, Laval is a former politician of the Third Republic. He is instrumental in the demise of the Republic by kind of lobbying MPs to vote the Republic out of existence in 1940. And he is prime minister or deputy prime minister twice. And he is the head of the government longest of all these ministers. He's often seen as, or he was seen in the past as sort of the evil genius behind collaboration, that it was his idea. We since now know that Pétain was more involved with it than was previously thought. And so that's Pierre Laval. And then we have a man called Admiral François Darlan, who is a very senior figure in the French Navy. And he runs Vichy as well for just over a year in between 1941 and 1942. And so what we have with Vichy is that we have a series of governments, and each of these governments sort of has its own agenda. It has its own ministers. They are pursuing different things, and they are all pursuing collaboration with Germany at this time. So the Vichy regime is not really monolithic in terms of its goals or its agenda, and in terms of its personnel.
Can I ask how many of these governmental figures in your research you found that are generally invested in France being in league with the Nazis?
That's a good question, because these men aren't generally recognised as fascists. There are fascists who come into government, but this is kind of in the very last months of the occupation. So January 1944, there's a government reshuffle, and what we might call genuine fascists are appointed. But this is because it's so desperate at the time. It's really the sharp end of the occupation. But before then, it's all their main aim is to secure the best position possible for France in Hitler's kind of new order, because obviously they think Hitler's won the war. So it's all about what can we get for France out of this. Now that involves throwing many people under the bus for their own national self-interest, but that's their main concern. How best can we make collaboration work for us, even if it means doing the Germans' bidding? What concessions can we get from them?
I was going to say, is it just a case of these are French men and French patriots just trying to make the best of an awful, awful situation in some circumstances?
Yes, given what they do with, that's the most positive.
We're going to get
assessment
to the bus throwing, aren't we?
Yes, but I think the problem they have is that they delude themselves into thinking that Hitler actually cares about France. So they think that Hitler will welcome France as a partner in the Nazi New Order, and that if they collaborate, they will get concessions from Hitler. Whereas Hitler just wants to milk France, and he wants to crush France, and he just wants to take it for all he can.
And he wants Paris as his showpiece, doesn't he? It's like...
Yes, so there's this famous film of Hitler visiting Paris just after the defeat of 1940, kind of as a tourist, really. And you can imagine what a prize Paris is, winning it in 1940, but he doesn't care about the French at all.
So let's get on to the National Revolution question. I mean, there was a National Revolution. What was it, and how did it all come about?
Okay, well, this is a favourite question that I like to ask students. What was the National Revolution? And I ask it because it's just quite difficult to answer.
Now it's your turn. You are now in the hot seat.
Yes, yeah, I'll provide the perfect exam response. So the National Revolution is that Vichy's programme for a complete renovation of the French nation. And if there's one goal behind it, it's to get rid of or to solve the problem of, or what it sees the problem of, decadence. So it thinks that decadence comes from the Republic, the interwar democracy. And what it means by decadence is moral decline and cultural decline, which it thinks has led to the defeat and the collapse of France and traditional French values being undermined by democratic ideas.
That's kind of parroting the whole attack on Weimar Germany, isn't it?
Yes. So it's this kind of Vichy has this idea of the Third Republic as sort of this anything goes regime where people have low morals, and it cites certain types of evidence to prove this contention. For example, the low birth rate in France, which is an obsession for some people in the interwar years, that men and women are not having enough children, and this is because they just want to live their own lives and have a nice time. So it says that this is one of the fundamental problems with France caused by democracy. And so this national revolution is its answer to this selfishness and individualism. The reason why it's so complex is because it has a lot of different political tendencies mixed in with it, partly because, as I've mentioned, there are lots of different people in government. There are several changes of government and several changes of the leaders of government. And so all of these people try to put their own stamp on what the National Revolution is and pursue their own agendas. So the historians have recognized sort of several key themes in this National Revolution, such as harking back to kind of a folkloric past where the peasant is this noble ideal, all the way to an obsession with efficiency and innovation. Under Admiral Darlan in 1941, he brings technocrats into government to try and modernize things like French agriculture. And then you have this smattering of like fascist style components too. So kind of like an idealization of like military discipline and self-reliance. A really significant thing about this National Revolution is that it's applied on a global scale through the empire. So the National Revolution decided upon in France has an impact around the world. And Vichy actually sees the empire as this place of experimentation where we can try new things. We can try and renovate French civilization through implementing the National Revolution abroad. And so we see it's even applied in the farthest reaches of the French Empire. So the colony that's furthest from France is the island of Reunion, which is in the Indian Ocean. People lose their jobs in the administration there because Vichy decides that naturalized foreigners should not work for the regime. So this National Revolution is sort of a global project for renovating France. And one thing I do like to also say to my students after I've asked them what the National Revolution is that I tell them what Pierre Laval said about the National Revolution at his trial at the end of the war. And he actually said that he didn't know what it was. So he's the head of government twice under Vichy. And he says that he never used the expression and that everyone just put their own stamp on it and it was never defined.
You know what, then? We have to throw in a clanger for all of your students that are going to rob your answer you've just given. Throw in a clanger. Like, so obviously one of the laws was that everybody had to wear a stripy jumper and a garlic string around their neck and ride a bicycle, wasn't it?
I know that was a much older law in France.
But it was revoked for the National Revolution.
Yes, yes.
Now, if a student parrots that back at you, that they've nicked your answer.
Oh, yes, and you can only drink red wine on a Sunday.
How decadent.
So there's the Vichy France government, they bring in so many new policies, don't they, at this point? I mean, there is an idea of gendered thinking within these policies. I mean, how does this actually affect the citizens?
So although I said the National Revolution is really eclectic and complex, this gendered vision of France runs throughout a lot of the policies, and it's a vision, you probably won't be surprised to hear, that men are the producers and women are the reproducers.
Oh, really?
Yes, so, I know. And this is partly based on this idea to, or this drive to combat depopulation, which some French have been concerned about since even the 1870s. This is blamed on a traditional, or a breakdown of traditional gender roles. So that, as I mentioned before, men and women are not having enough children, and partly because they are not performing their gender duty. So men are not fathering enough children. They are not virile enough. They've been feminized by democracy, and women are moving out of the home and think that they have a right to do so. So Vichy decides, well, we're going to put them back in their rightful places.
Yeah, a load of old men decided that women should just stay at home and have babies.
Yes,
I know. In history before.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. So they introduce policies directed specifically at people having larger families. So they introduce agencies to encourage people through things like financial incentives. They celebrate things like Mother's Day. They award medals to mothers with lots of children. But it also runs out throughout other policies as well. So, for example, this idealization of the peasant, which is quite central to Vichy's propaganda. This is linked to the fact that hard work, kind of toiling in the fields, is seen as a sign of kind of moral probity and virility and child rearing, away from kind of unhealthy temptations. So we see this gender thinking in throughout the National Revolution. Now, one of the most serious things or pieces of legislation that Vichy introduces is called the 300 Law, because it was the 300th law of the regime. And this is very repressive in terms of repressing abortion. So it makes abortion a crime against not only society, but also the state and the French race. And it means that French abortionists and women seeking abortion can be tried in the same courts as terrorists and resistors, and they can receive the death penalty for this. So Vichy really wants to control the private lives of families and the public lives of families, but women in particular, again, unsurprisingly.
I don't know what to comment about that, because
I think I speak for both of us when I say,
yes.
That's a better response. Thank you. Because I'm sitting here in a bit of like stunned silence, thinking, how am I going to respond to this?
I mean, they are baby Nazis, aren't they?
Yeah, totally.
Same as the sort of blonde woman with the plaits in all the pictures giving birth to loads of Aryan children in Nazi propaganda in the 30s, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think we can at least say that there is kind of transnational similarities, and that these, because I suppose we have to remember that these movements all borrow from each other, and they have much longer histories than say just starting in 1940. So these ideas, Vichy does take it to the next level, but these ideas about depopulation and banning abortion and things like that, they are been around in France for decades.
One organisation that's really familiar to everybody is the Hitler Youth. And what kind of parallels can you draw? Because Vichy has youth camps, don't they? Are they the same thing? How do they operate?
They have two youth organisations. So there's one called the Companions of France, which is for teenagers and children up to the age of 20, I suppose. It's voluntary, this one. So they live in camps. They do outdoor labour and social work, and it's all heavily infused with this National Revolution propaganda. It's a bit like the Scouts, more so than the Hitler Youth, these Companions of France. There is also something called the Chantier de la Jeunesse, which translates as like the construction sites of youth, which is for men aged 21. And it's to replace national service, because the French can't enroll people in national service anymore under the terms of the armistice. So they have these youth camps where men go and live for 8 months. There's a heavy emphasis on military style discipline. There's a heavy emphasis on morality as defined by Vichy, and the cult of Marshal Pétain. And the hope is that if all 21-year-old men go and live in these camps, this will combat the decadence instilled in them by the Republic, and so that they will go on and transform France as older adults. It's not very popular in France, partly because the Vichy has these big ideas, but due to the constraints of wartime, there's a lack of food in the camps, there's poor housing, and many men are just bored, doubtless bored by Vichy's kind of healthy body, healthy mind philosophy.
You mentioned this previously about, you know, daily life doesn't really change so much at the beginning of the regime, but does this actually change at all as we go through towards the end of the war?
So it's very difficult life in France at the this time. There are lots of shortages. There is rationing. Rationing comes in pretty much straight away in autumn 1940, and the rations for adults. There is a category A of adult rations, which is the majority of French people, so age between 20 and 70. These are very meagre. So the majority of French are living on 1,300 calories a day on these state rations. You only get like 50 grams of rice a month, or 250 grams of pasta a month, which is hardly anything. It's barely more than a handful. And often even these meagre rations are not available in their entirety. So in 1942 and 44 in particular, there are shortages of the rations too. So it's very difficult to put food on the table. And this is compounded by shortages. It means long queues at shops to get your rations. And possibly when you get to the front of the queue, the ration is not there. There are shortages, partly because a lot of men are away in Germany as prisoners of war. There's about 1.5 million men held in Germany as a POW, but also because Germany takes food from France. So it takes like a fifth of the meat that France produces is taken by Germany. And so Germany is partly responsible for this shortfall. And all this just encourages the black market, really. Most French have to resort to black market goods to survive, whether it's food or clothing. And of course, this is very uneven, depending on where you live, what you have access to on the black market, and also how much money you have, because, of course, prices are very much inflated on the black market. And there are severe repressive measures against black marketeers. All the while, the French government doesn't really recognise that actually it's German soldiers that are partly funding the black market.
Am I surprised?
I doubt it.
Not remotely. Do you know what? Alina, you asked this question. Why would I be asking this question? You go for it.
I love that.
We can feign that it's my turn and everything, but why would I be asking a question about the Holocaust? Go for it.
Right. So, I'm going to ask it slightly differently, because I've written it down in such a way that it's just there's no impact to that. So what I've actually written is, how were the Jews treated in Vichy France? But I want to know a little bit more in depth. I just don't want to ask that simple basic question. How was the Jewish population treated in comparison with, for example, the occupied zones? I mean, what was the difference in their life? Obviously, we know that in, you know, Paris and bigger cities and everything, Jews were being rounded up, sent to Drancy onto Auschwitz, they were selected and sent to the gas chambers. But was this different in Vichy France?
To begin with, the the statistics for France or the French participation in the Holocaust are that 80,000 Jews died. The majority of those Jews were deported to the east, where they died, but roughly 4,000 of them died in French internment camps, because there is a network of camps within France, whether they are sort of holding camps before the Jews are deported, or whether they're just internment camps or like prison camps. Vichy is an anti-Semitic regime, so it draws on a long history of anti-Semitism in France, going back at least as far as the Dreyfus affair in the 1890s, this anti-Semitic scandal that split the country. This is exacerbated in the 30s when you have large immigrant Jewish populations fleeing to France for asylum from Central and Eastern Europe. And there is a revival of anti-Semitism in France in the 1930s. These fascist parties are generally anti-Semitic. So Vichy begins by introducing what it calls a Jewish statute in October 1940. Before this date, foreign Jews, or some foreign Jews, have already been arrested. And this is a really important point, because Vichy treats foreign Jews differently to French-born Jews. I'll say more about that in a minute. But this Jewish statute in October 1940, it defines who is a Jew, and it lists the occupations and things that these Jews can't do, or the roles they can't perform. So, for example, the professions that they will be excluded from. Vichy introduces a second Jewish statute in 1941. Again, it defines Jews or who is a Jew, but it narrows the definition. So, it widens the definition, so more people can fall under this definition. And it extends the list of occupations that Jews are banned from. Now, the motivation behind this does not come from Germany. These are French-inspired measures. They are inspired by this history of anti-Semitism. They are also inspired by the logic of collaboration. So the French think, well, if we do this, this might please the Germans, and we might get something from them. And these are just the most famous examples of Vichy's anti-Semitic legislation. There are lots of other anti-Semitic laws and restrictions that Vichy introduces. And these laws apply around the world. So that the handful of Jews living in Madagascar and Indochina, they are subject to Vichy's anti-Semitism as well. Now, Vichy becomes embroiled in the Holocaust in 1942, when Germany begins to ask for quotas of Jews from the occupied territories. This is when the regime begins to arrest Jewish people very publicly. The most famous arrest is in July 1942, that called the Veldiv Roundup, where the French police, and it's important that we say that the French police arrest thousands of Jews in Paris and hold them in the Veldiv cycling stadium in Paris before deporting them. Now, Vichy is not so comfortable with deporting French Jews. And this is where the distinction with foreign Jews comes in, because Laval, who is in charge at this time, says to the Germans, well, we don't really want to give you the quota of French Jews that you've asked for, but we've got these immigrants that we don't want in our country, so you can have those instead. So these Jews who've been arrested and held in Vichy's internment camps from early in the war, they are deported. And that is a French decision. And Laval goes one better, and this is something I always hate saying in my lectures and telling my students, because Laval says to the Germans, well, don't just take the adults, because we don't want to look after the children. You can have the children as well. So, and that was a French decision, and it meant that 11,000 children from France were deported and murdered in Eastern Europe. So the French regime, as I've said, is anti-Semitic, and it is closely involved in the murder of these 80,000 Jews during the occupation.
It just, it beggars belief.
I know, it's
children to be murdered, it just...
Yeah, as I said, it's always difficult when it comes to the class where I have to tell the students that, because I don't want to my voice to break when I'm telling them, because it's so upsetting. Now, one of the things we have to recognise when we're as well as talking about all these Jews that died, is that three quarters of Jews in France actually survived the war. So 75% were not deported. And this has led after the war, and actually recently, for some people to make an apology for Vichy by saying, well, Vichy can't have been all that bad because 75% of these Jews survived. And some recent historians have tried to write the history of France's participation in the Holocaust as one of protection and rescue rather than being complicit in the deportation of the Jews. Now, I think from my point of view, I think that's outrageous, because what we have to recognise is that without Vichy's help, without these French policemen arresting Jews, what could the Germans have done? They couldn't have arrested them themselves.
There's no resources to go out and round people up, is there? Just say no.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree with this argument, and people have shot me down. So, Chris, I really want to say thank you for bringing this point up. It is so important we talk about it, and we're not talking about it.
Yes, yeah. So Hitler would not divert soldiers from fighting the Soviet Union to arrest Jews in France. So without the French police doing it, there is no one else. There are some explanations that might explain the survival of the Jews. For example, the geography of France means that Jews can hide better than in other countries. The fact that France is liberated in 1944 before maybe the Holocaust radicalizes to its ultimate extent, that may have saved some Jews. The fact that Hitler wanted to do different things in France than in Eastern Europe, so he's less concerned with ethnically cleansing the territories of France. But to rewrite the history as one in which the French come out as the heroes is unacceptable from my point of view.
This is where our questions ended, but I just think there's one more we have to ask. You've mentioned one word earlier on, and that was trials. These people in government, the Vichy government, I mean, I've already alluded to it as well. Pétain's reputation is utterly ruined. He's remembered as a traitor now, regardless of the First World War. Anyone with a picture of him on their bedroom wall now has got a screw loose in France. But what are the consequences for these men at the end of the war?
Laval is executed. So Pierre Laval, who's twice led the government, he's executed. Admiral Darlan, who was also head of government, he was actually assassinated midway through the war in December 1942. Marshal Pétain does stand trial and he is sentenced to death. But Charles de Gaulle, who is then leader of the provisional government in France, commutes it to kind of a life in exile. So he is exiled to a small island off the Atlantic coastline where he lives for about five more years and becomes senile, really. So Pétain is
saying... World War One service that buys him that concession, isn't it?
Yes, and perhaps because he's a very old man at that time. He's also, he's not a friend of de Gaulle, but they've known each other for a long time too. But yes, his legacy, his story of heroism from the First World War counts a lot for the decision that de Gaulle makes. And in fact, today he is remembered obviously more for Vichy than for what he did in the First World War. But recently in 2016, when it was the anniversary of the Battle of Verdun, Pétain, of course, known as the victor of Verdun for seemingly turning around the French army. At that time, there was still a debate in France about, well, should we remember Pétain for what he did in the First World War at this time and just ignore the fact that he was complicit in such misery afterwards? So there was still a debate about it.
Chris, I mean, I always enjoy a World War II podcast, but today I have been so captivated by everything you've said. I've learned so much more about Vichy France and even agreed with you very many times, which has absolutely excellent for me. And I know Alex has enjoyed this. So thank you so much for joining us today. And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget to go to our online bookstore to grab yourself a copy of this book. It is such a great book. I can't recommend it any more than I'm recommending it now. So thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.